There was a school for aspiring Formula One racing drivers on a neglected concrete circuit near Ostia on the road from Rome. The course lasted 3 weeks and cost $500 American. David stayed at the Excelsior in the Via Veneta and commuted each day to the track. He completed the full course, but after the first week knew it was not what he wanted. The physical limitation of the track was constricting after flying the high heavens, and even the crackling, snarling power of a Tyrrell Ford could not match the thrust from the engine of a jet interceptor. Although he lacked the dedication and motivation of others in his class, his natural talent for speed and his coordination brought him out high in the finishing order, and he had an offer to drive on the works team of a new and struggling company that was building and fielding a production team of Formula One racing machines. Of course, the salary was starvation, and it was a measure of his desperation that he came close to signing a contract for the season. But at the last moment, he changed his mind and went on. In Athens, he spent a week hanging around the yacht basins of Piraeus and Glyfada. He was investigating the prospects of buying a motor yacht and running it out on charter to the islands. The prospect of sun and sea and pretty girls seemed appealing, and the craft themselves were beautiful in their snowy paint and varnished teak work. In 1 week, he learned that charter work was merely running a seagoing boarding house for a bunch of bored, sunburned, and seasick tourists. On the seventh day, the American Sixth Fleet dropped anchor in the Bay of Athens. David sat at a table of one of the beachfront cafes and drank ouzo in the sun while he studied the anchored aircraft carriers through his binoculars. On the great flat tops, the rows of crusaders and phantoms were grouped with their wings folded. Watching them, he felt a consuming hunger, a need that was almost spiritual. He had searched the earth, it seemed, and there was nothing for him upon its face. He laid the binoculars aside, and he looked up into the sky. The clouds were high, a brilliant silver against the blue. He picked up the glass of milky ouzo that the sun had warmed and rolled its sweet licorice taste about his tongue. East, west, home is best. He spoke aloud and had a mental image of Paul Morgan sitting in his high office of glass and steel. Like a patient fisherman, he tended his lines laid across the world. Right now, the one to Athens was beginning to twitch. He could imagine the quiet satisfaction as he began to reel it in, drawing David struggling feebly back to the center. What the hell? I could still fly Impalas as a reserve officer, he thought. And there was always the leer, if he could get it away from Barney. David drained the glass and stood up abruptly, feeling the fading glow of his defiance. He flagged a cab and was driven back to his room at the Grand Bretagne on Syndagma Square. His defiance was dying so swiftly that one of his companions for dinner that night was John Donopoulos, Morgan Group's agent for Greece, a slim, elegant sophisticate with an unlined, suntanned face, silver wings in his hair, and an elegantly casual way of dressing. John had selected for David's table companion the female star of a number of Italian spaghetti westerns, a young lady of ample bosom and dark, flashing eye whose breathing and bosom had become agitated when John introduced David as a diamond millionaire from Africa. Diamonds were the most glamorous, although not the most significant, of Morgan Group's interests. They sat upon the terrace of Dionysus, for the evening was mild. The restaurant was carved into the living rock of the hilltop of Lysabettus under the Church of St. Paul. Down the zigzag path from the church, the Easter procession of worshippers unwound in a flickering stream of candle flames through the pine forest below them, and the singing carried sweetly on the still night air. On its far hilltop, the stately columns of the Acropolis were floodlit, so that they glowed as creamily as ancient ivory. And beyond that again, on the midnight waters of the bay, the American fleet wore gay garlands of fairy lights. "The glory that was Greece," murmured the star of Italian westerns, as though she voiced the wisdom of the ages, and placed one heavily jeweled hand on David's thigh, while with the other she raised a glass of red Samos wine to him and cast him a look under thick eyelashes that was fraught with significance. Her restraint was impressive, and it was only after they had eaten the main course of savory meats wrapped in vine leaves and swimming in creamy lemon sauce that she suggested that David might like to finance her next movie. Let's find some place where we can talk about it, she murmured. And what better place than her suite? John Dinopoulos waved them away with a grin and a knowing wink, a gesture that annoyed David, for it made him see the whole episode for the emptiness that it was. The star's suite was pretentious, with thick white carpets and bulky black leather furniture. David poured himself a drink while she went to change into clothing more suitable for a discussion of high finance. David tasted the drink, realized that he did not want it, and left it on the bar counter. The star came out of the bedroom in a bedrobe of white satin, which was cut back from arm and bosom and was so sheer that her flesh gleamed with a pearly pink sheen through the material. Her hair was loose, a great wild mane of swirling curls, and suddenly David was sick of the whole business. I'm sorry, he said. John was joking. I'm not a millionaire, and I really prefer boys. He heard his untouched glass shatter against the door of the suite as he closed it behind him. Back at his own hotel, he ordered coffee from room service, and then on an impulse he picked up the telephone again and placed a Cape Town call. It came through with surprising speed, and the girl's voice on the other end was thickened with sleep. Mitzi, he laughed. How's the girl? Where are you, warrior? Are you home? I'm in Athens, doll. Athens, God, how's the action? It's a drag. Yeah, I bet, she scoffed. The Greek girls are never going to be the same again. How are you, Mitzi? I'm in love, Davy. I mean, really in love. It's far out. We're going to be married. Isn't that just something else? David felt a spur of anger, jealous of the happiness in her voice. That's great, doll. Do I know him? Cecil Lawley. You know him. He's one of Daddy's accountants. David recalled a large, pale-faced, bespectacled man with a serious manner. Congratulations, said David. He felt very much alone again, far from home, and aware that life there flowed on without his presence. You want to talk to him? Mitzi asked. I'll wake him up. There was murmur and mutter on the other end. Then Cecil came on. Nice work, David told him. And it really was. Mitzi's share of Morgan Group would be considerably larger than David's. Cecil had drilled himself an oil well in a most unconventional manner. Thanks, Davy. Cecil's embarrassment at being caught tending his oil well carried clearly over 5,000 miles of telephone cable. Listen, lover, you do anything to hurt that girl, I'll personally tear out your liver and stuff it down your throat, okay? Okay, said Cecil, and his alarm was brittle in his tone. I'll put you back to Mitzi. She prattled on for another $50 worth before hanging up. David lay on the bed with his hands behind his head and thought about his dumpy, soft-hearted cousin and her new happiness. Then, quite suddenly, he made the decision which had been lurking at the edge of his consciousness all these weeks since leaving Spain. He picked up the phone again and asked for the porter's desk. I'm sorry to trouble you at this time of the morning, he said, but I should like to get on a flight to Israel as soon as possible. Will you please arrange that? The sky was filled with a soft golden haze that came off the desert. The gigantic TWA 747 came down through it, and David had a glimpse of dark green citrus orchards before the solid jolt of the touchdown. Lod was like any other airport in the world, but beyond its doors was a land like no other he had ever known. The crowd who fought him for a seat in one of the big black Chirots, communal taxis plastered with stickers and hung with gewgaws, made even the Italians seem shining towers of restrained good manners. Once aboard, however, it was as though they were on a family outing, and he a member of that family. On one side of him, a paratrooper in beret and blouse with his winged insignia on the breast, and an Uzi submachine gun slung about his neck, offered him a cigarette. On the other, a big strapping lass, also in khaki uniform, and with the dark gazelle eyes of an Israeli, which became even darker and more soulful when she looked at David, which was often, shared a sandwich of unleavened bread and balls of fried chickpeas, the ubiquitous pita and falafel, with him, and practiced her English upon him. All the occupants of the front seat turned around to join the conversation, and this included the driver, who nevertheless did not allow his speed to diminish in the slightest, and who punctuated his remarks with fierce blasts of his horn and cries of outrage at pedestrians and other drivers. The perfume of orange blossom lay as heavily as sea mist upon the coastal lowlands, and always afterwards it would be for David the smell of Israel. Then they climbed into the Judean hills, and David felt a sense of nostalgia as they followed the winding highway through pine forests and across the pale, shining slopes where the white stone gleamed like bone in the sunlight and the silver olive trees twisted their trunks in graceful agony upon the terraces which were the monuments to 6,000 years of man's patient labor. It was so familiar and yet subtly different from those fair and well-beloved hills of the Southern Cape he called home. There were flowers he did not recognize, crimson blooms like spilled blood, and bursts of sunshine yellow blossoms upon the slopes. Then suddenly a pang that was like a physical pain as he glimpsed the bright flight of chocolate and white wings amongst the trees, and he recognized the crested head of an African hoopoe, a bird which was a symbol of home. He felt a sense of excitement building within him, unformed and undirected as yet, but growing as he drew closer to the woman he had come to see, and to something else of which he was as yet uncertain. There was, at last, a sense of belonging. He felt in sympathy with the young persons who crowded close to him in the cab. "See," cried the girl, touching his arm and pointing to the wreckage of war still strewn along the roadside, the burned-out carapaces of trucks and armored vehicles, preserved as a memorial to the men who died on the road to Jerusalem. "There was fighting here." David turned in the seat to study her face, and he saw again the strength and certainty that he had so admired in Deborah. These were a people who lived each day to its limit, and only at its close did they consider the next. "Will there be more fighting?" he asked. "Yes," she answered him without hesitation. "Why?" "Because if it is good, you must fight for it." And she made a wide gesture that seemed to embrace the land and all its people. "And this is ours, and it is good," she said. "Right on, doll," David agreed with her, and they grinned at each other. So they came to Jerusalem with its tall, severe apartment blocks of custard yellow stone, standing like monuments upon the hills, grouped about the massive walled citadel that was its heart. TWA had reserved a room at the Intercontinental Hotel for David while on board the inward flight. From his window, he looked across the Garden of Gethsemane at the old city, at its turrets and spires, and the blazing golden dome of the rock, center of Christianity and Judaism, holy place of the Muslims, battleground of 2,000 years, ancient land reborn, and David felt a sense of awe. For the first time in his life, he recognized and examined that portion of himself that was Jewish, and he thought it was right that he should have come to this city. "Perhaps," he said aloud, "it's just possible that this is where it's all at." It was early evening when David paid off the cab in the car park of the university and submitted to a perfunctory search by a guard at the main gate. Here, body search was a routine that would soon become so familiar as to pass unnoticed. He was surprised to find the campus almost deserted until he remembered it was Friday and that the whole tempo was slowing for the Sabbath. The redbud trees were in full bloom around the main plaza and the ornamental pool as David crossed to the admin block and asked for her at the inquiries desk, where the porter was on the point of leaving his post. "Miss Mordecai," the porter checked his list. "Yes, English department, on the second floor of the Lauterman building," he pointed out through the glass doors. "Third building on your right, go right on in."